Back in 1940, eight sensational heroes united to create the world's very first superhero team, the Justice Society of America. Now, 85 years later, we're gathering podcasters and bloggers from around the globe for a month-long celebration in an event we're calling JS April. Throughout April 2025, join dozens of all-star podcasters and bloggers as they each share their own unique tributes to the original and greatest superhero team, covering exciting topics like
Superman Family Number 211, October 1981.
Mr. and Mrs. Superman attend the wedding of Batman and Catwoman.
JSA Number 1 from 2024.
JSA 68 through 72.
All-Star Comics Number 58.
JSA Number 59 from 2004.
Justice League of America 171.
And Justice League of America 172.
The Legacy of the JSA Character Names.
The Brave and the Bold Number 61.
The Golden Age Wonder Woman JSA Adventure.
JLA JSA Virtue and Vice 2002.
DC Special Number 29 featuring the Untold Origin of the Justice Society.
Infinity Inc. Annual Number 1. JSA Number 38. And the Stargirl TV series.
Justice Society of America Number 6 from 1993.
Justice Society of America Number 20.
Justice Society of America Annual Number 1, 2008.
Justice Society of America Number 10 from 2007.
All-Star Comics Number 4 from 1941.
The Wonder Woman Spectacular from 1978.
Celebrate with JSA 85th birthday cookies.
The 1987 Infinity Inc. and Outsiders specials.
Wanted, the world's most dangerous villains Number 6 from 1973.
The recent Alan Scott Green Lantern miniseries.
Examining the role of the Justice Society in the crisis.
And the effect the crisis had on the team.
More Fun Comics 55 from 1940.
Contrasting the Justice Society of America versus Marvel's Invaders.
In Post-Crisis, how the JSA inspired the JLA.
Justice League of America number 29 through 30, plus The Flash number 123.
Golden Age Origins number 1.
Showcase number 97 to 99 from 1978.
The Justice Society versus Extant.
All-Star Squadron, issues 19 and 20 from 1983.
All-Star Comics, issues 60 to 63.
JSA number 56 through number 58 from 2004.
JSA, The Liberty File.
Justice Society of America, Thy Kingdom Come.
And that's just some of the topics that will be covered during the celebration. Get ready for a thrilling month of beloved characters, fascinating insights, and incredible stories. Follow the action on social media with the hashtag JSApril. And visit our website for a complete list of participating podcasters, bloggers, and what they're each covering at fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSApril.
Back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here with my nemesis, Professor Alan Middleton. Why is he my nemesis? Because he's not older than me.
That makes everybody you know your nemesis.
No, it is my good friend Kirk Greenfield, who's my. What can I tell you? He's still podcasting, Kirk. So there's somebody who's older than me who's actually putting out product. And
at
just
this
to,
point, I just like to think of it as someone with slightly more life experience than me, a life veteran.
Just to give the listeners some basis for what we're talking about here, because the stuff we were talking about before we started to record is not going into the episode. Professor Allen practically begged me to continue podcasting because he's happy to have somebody older than him who is doing this. It makes him feel, I guess it makes you feel like you don't have to stop.
Makes me feel young.
You know what? We could break into the Sinatra song right now. Or not. So, how you been? We haven't had a chance to talk for a while.
Not too shabby. Always good to be back on the show. Always good to see the cheapskate signal lighting up the skies over Bin's HQ.
It's a giant penny symbol. But I understand you survived a meeting with Scott and Bill.
Oof, how about that? How about that?
You know, the beauty of it is that no matter how hard they try to pick your pocket, there's nothing in there but quarters anyway.
The good news was, I finished up my Warlord collection during that run.
And started Bill on a Warlord run.
Bill on one. Sucker!
Not only did you guys start Bill on it, but we've had some talks on it here where he all of a sudden thinks that there's books in that Warlord run that should be, like, expensive. And that's, to me, that's insanity. Nope. Warlord does not equal expensive.
Yep. Nope.
I love me some Mike Grell. I'm not you know, criticizing the quality, but they just don't go for big bucks. I had bought a copy of the first issue special, which introduced him, from a like a $3 bin, and I already had a copy of it, and I gave that copy to a buddy of mine because I saw it for $3. I was like, how could I just walk away from that?
Yeah. I think in wrapping up my collection, I think issue one I think cost me maybe $8 to $10, which for me, you know, that is commitment. And then the last ones I picked up were $4 or $5. You know, the last four or five issues were about $4 or $5 each.
And that's probably
down in the single digits and the teens. Once you get past that, they are quarter bin fodder.
But the only reason you paid that money for them is probably because you were so close to completing your collection. Because if you hadn't been so close and you said, no, that's too expensive, I'm going to keep searching.
I a young person like myself, Paul, I have time to finish up my collection. I understand some of us on this call, you know, you might need to strike while the iron's hot sometimes.
Yeah, I could at least, while I can get my old decrepit hands to page through it still.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what's going to go first. Is it the arthritis in the fingers going through the boxes? Is it going to be the eyes to be able to read the indicia on the inside cover? I'm just trying to figure out what part of my body is going to break down first. You know, I am really good still about getting down on the floor to look through boxes. You know, standing up is not quite as easy as it used to be, but getting down on the floor, I got no problem with that.
Yeah, I know. I totally get that. I can still force myself to do that, but I am now not so quick to reject the offer of a stool or chair.
There you go. Yes. Yes.
I accept those offers much quicker than I used to.
Agreed. Agreed. One of the stores around here has a nice rolling chair. Okay. You know you know the comic book demographic.
It's good to have friends, you know, who own the store, or to become friends with the people who own the stores. And I have become very friendly with one of the main store that I go to, which I'll even throw out to people if anybody in Long Island is looking. Kyle's Comics, great store, really great guy that runs it. And I go to there's a monthly show that's only 5 minutes from my house. It's usually I get free passes, so I don't even pay to go in. And he's got a table there. And most of the time I actually don't buy anything from him at the show, because at the show he brings like books from the 90s to now, and I'm always looking for 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. I don't even know why I said 50s. I probably own like one or two books that are in the 1950s. But anyway, last time I went to the show, he said, you know, if you get tired, I got a chair here behind the table. Just come on over and sit down. So it's good to have friends in the business.
Absolutely. That's awesome. That's awesome. I believe I have one comic from certainly the best deal I've ever gotten. Was a 1958 issue of Black Hawk that I got from a quarter bin.
Wow.
At a used bookstore, meaning they didn't know what they had.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, you know, decent enough condition.
That's
one of the all-time great buys.
We've talked about this on the show in the past, where them not knowing what they have or not knowing the business is either a huge perk to us or a huge detriment. Because when they, you know, either they're way underpricing it or they say, well, it says in the comic guide this goes for $600, so that's the price. Meanwhile, you're finding it in, you know, $2 bins.
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyway, what have you been reading lately?
Well, you know, I, in terms of reading, I'm just working my way through whatever happens to be in the next on the list, including spoilers, the book I'm going to cover today. Just grabbed it off the off the top of the list. But
yeah, that's an interesting one, honestly. I think it's gonna be for some good discussion. But yeah, you know, I want to mention, because again, before we were recording, the good professor mentioned that he's been doing on his show, the Quarterman podcast. I don't have to hide the name. He's been doing issues of The Champions, which, if you know, our loyal listeners will recall, we covered issue 3 here recently. And he is coming up to issue episode 225 of his show soon. And basically every episode divisible by 25, or a quarter, if you will, I usually am invited and come on the show and do it with the good professor. So we will be covering on issue 225 of his show, Champions issues 14 and 15. Yep. So I am very much looking forward to that, and I'm recommending to anybody listening who does not already listen to the Quarter Bin podcast to make a point of listening to that, because we'll have fun, because we always do.
Absolutely.
Just two young guys looking at funny books.
Two young guys looking at funny books from when they were young, I think is what you meant.
What I really mean is two old geezers looking at funny books from when they were young.
That's some truth.
Which is kind of what we're doing today. So,
yeah.
As my special former intern guest, I'm giving you the choice. Would you like to do yours first or mine?
It is tricky because yours is earlier, but mine is the Marvel. But then again, I picked mine first, and I think you responded to it in our game of Back to the Bins chess that we always seem to play. So I will go first because I picked first.
Okay.
And we are looking at Machine Man, number 15, cover dated June 1980, at an astonishing cover price of 40 cents. Now, I wanted to check that number based on the last 45 years of inflation, which you think would be a whole lot of inflation. But according to the online inflation calculator, something that was 40 cents in 1980 should be, Paul, I don't want to put you on the spot, about what would you guess?
I'm guessing 2 1/4.
$1.54.
Okay, but if you went to buy this issue now, it would certainly be at least
about 2 1/4.
No, it would certainly be at least $3.99.
Yep. Oh yeah, yeah, new. Yep. That's
if this was a new issue coming out today. Yeah.
That's the crazy thing. New comics are about twice to three times what they quote unquote should be based on.
But I believe that is not based on inflation. I believe that is based on changes in the industry and the fact that when Machine Man 15 came out, the average book probably had a circulation of over 100,000.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas nowadays, the average book probably has a circulation of about 30,000. And I'm throwing those numbers against the wall. I don't really know the accuracy.
I think you're in the ballpark.
Nowadays, if you sold 100,000 of a book, that would be considered a huge seller.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So their cost per book to distribute and pay, combined with inflation, does justify the cost that they have. but it also, the course justifies my not buying them.
Check and mate. True and true. Mm. So, Machine Man 15, the cover by the legendary Steve Ditko, shows our title character approaching a fight scene where an orange, green, squishy figure thing is locked in combat with half the Fantastic Four. The Thing and the Torch are whipped. Now there's only MM.
And who's MM?
I understand that MM is Machine Man's initials, but that is about the lamest nickname I've ever heard.
That really is. That's worse than calling Reed Richards Stretcho or Giant Man High Pockets.
Oh, mercy me. You know, there are a lot of contrasting colors in this color, in this cover, and there's a sense of movement and of action, and it is weird. That's for sure. Quick thoughts on the cover?
I am always hesitant to criticize Steve Ditko because he is legendary, and his work in the 1960s on Spider-Man and on Doctor Strange, and even on things like Blue Beetle and stuff like that, are outstanding as far as I'm concerned. And most of that is a result of his use of shading and storytelling and things like that. Now, certainly you're not going to have the storytelling per se on a cover image, which is generally a poster image, but Steve Ditko does not lend himself very well to bright colors, which this cover has. And I have often made excuses for Mr. Ditko's work in his later years, saying that, well, you know, he's penciling it and he's getting inkers who are afraid to really put their thumbprint on it by being, you know, a little overly aggressive on the shadowing and all of that. And sometimes the shadowing in Steve Ditko's work was my favorite part.
Right, yeah.
Now, in this particular issue, that excuse falls flat because he did his own inking. Yeah. But I think, you know, maybe as the years went by, he tended to, I don't know if he tended just to move more quickly on his work and didn't do the shadow work that he would do as a younger man, or if, you know, at this point in his life he's just like, you know, this is just work for hire and I don't really care. I don't know what it was, because Steve Ditko was a known recluse who didn't do any interviews, so we don't know what he was thinking. But I'm thinking that, you know, he would pump it out, and I really wish there was a competent hand to ink it, because I still see breakdowns that fit the Steve Ditko mold. Mm-hmm. But the actual artwork, and I mean, I guess I'm getting into the interiors a little bit too here. We're just talking the cover. But, yeah. You know, I would love to see this same. I would love to see somebody take the pencils from this. Somebody like, you know, somebody like Terry Austin, or, you know, even a... Frank Miller's inker, John Romita Jr.'s inker.
Klaus
Janson. I couldn't think of his name. You know what? I think Klaus Janson taking Steve Ditko's pencils would probably make for an awesome combination.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would love to see that.
And shady, you know.
Yeah, I would love to have seen them do that with this. But, you know, that's a wish that will never be fulfilled. So that is my long-winded way of saying I'm disappointed with the cover. It really doesn't grab me at all.
I get you. Well, we start in the headquarters of Delmar Insurance, where Aaron Stack, who is secretly Machine Man, works as the company's top investigator. Spoilers! Top investigator. His colleagues Maggie and Eddie make fun of him, but Pamela Quinn, the prim and proper file clerk, defends Stack. Pamela was introduced by Tom DeFalco a few issues back, and spoilers for later issues, she does become a love interest. Do not believe I mentioned that the story is Kill Me or Cure Me, written by Tom DeFalco with art by Steve Ditko. Now, the first 9 issues of this were completely done by Jack Kirby. And then Wolfman and Ditko took over after that. And at this point, Wolfman has just left for DC. So this, so Tom DeFalco is writing us, writing here. So, we turn our attention across town to Alternative Resources Center, which is about as bland a name for a company as you can come up with. I think they just don't want attention. I just think they just don't want attention.
But it's energy for tomorrow.
Woohoo! You know, it's not nuclear, it's new clear. It's all in the branding, Paul. It's all in the branding.
Alternative Resources Center could be known as ARC. ARC Technologies sounds a little bit more...
Not bad. You know, these... we hear that this is the country's most renowned, most respected scientific research facility. I mean, except for Star Labs, but I guess we're not doing a cross-company crossover here, so we'll have to trust them on that. So, at the company, Dr. Valletta Todd, who was both a brilliant physicist and a gorgeous bundle of fluff, is working to develop a clean, cheap energy source, utilizing the power in ionized gas. But even a genius grows occasionally careless, and a power overload transforms her lab into a seething nightmare. Inside, the doctor is battered by wild, uncontrollable electromagnetic energies. The research company happens to be a client of Stax Insurance Company, and he is dispatched immediately to assess the damage and see what help he can offer. And as Machine Man, he saves a pair of trapped employees. He then super stretches his arms through the entire building to seek out more survivors, and he's led to the laboratory. But what he finds there is not Dr. Todd in her human form, for she has changed, transmuted into an inhuman gaseous monster. And it's a funny thing, Paul. It's a... You said I was down in Orlando over the holiday break visiting a couple of your bins mates. And that is exactly how Scott Gardner described Dr. Bill.
And he was a gaseous monster. I was going to say, if I have enough green vegetables, I could become an inhuman gaseous monster.
So she fears that she is losing her tenuous grip on humanity. Unable to maintain an even faintly human form, she's gone berserk, blasting bolts of pure electromagnetic energy at random. One direct hit, and Machine Man will be as functional as a blown fuse. The energy being, who will be dubbed Ion by the press, blasts a hole in the floor, and Machine Man tumbles through. The foundation starts to give way, but a damaged Machine Man does escape. But he's lost control and can't stop himself. He manages to direct himself into a deserted auto yard where the owner of the place, a new character named Gears Garvin, fixes up his arm and replaces his damaged legs with a wheel. And somewhere, Tony Stark thinks to himself that that is such a better choice than roller skates. So, yes, that is correct. This is Gears Garvin's debut issue. So I'm not saying you need to run out and slab this issue, Paul, but I hear that Gears Garvin is going to be in Guardians of the Galaxy.
I was going to say, once he appears in the MCU, all of a sudden this book is going for $50-$60.
So, meanwhile, somewhere in mid-Manhattan, Ion has pulled herself together a bit and realizes her limitations. She must go to those who possess the power and knowledge to help her. She must go to the Fantastic Four. Her plan is to force them to kill me or cure me, which, if you remember, is the title of the story. Unfortunately, she sets off the security alarm, and unfortunately, the thing is taking a bath at the time, raising just way too many questions for us to answer here on one episode of Back to the Bins. Machine Man hears a disturbance at the Baxter Building, puts two and two together, and heads that direction. Oh, sorry. Puts two and two together and comes up with Fantastic Four.
Ba-doom-ba.
And heads that direction. Johnny and Ben do their best to battle the electromagnetic blasts from Ion, but she is holding her own against the Fantastic Two. By the time Machine Man rolls on into the scene, and since this is a Marvel comic, Johnny and Ben decide that Machine Man is an enemy and that they must fight. In all the confusion, Ion has come to one clear conclusion that the Fantastic Four has neither the ingenuity nor the strength to destroy her, so she goes elsewhere. There's a very, very small asterisk and a footnote that says, so she goes to Dr. Doom. Anyway, that should have been, what could have been, Paul, what could have been?
What should have been.
Oh. So meanwhile, back at the Baxter Building, it is indeed clobbering time. Realizing that this is his comic book, Machine Man manages to escape the clutches of the thing. And he finds Ion out on the street and lures her into a butcher shop and then into the freezer, solidifying her body. And though he has defeated Ion, Machine Man feels no sense of triumph. They were similar. Both outsiders, unique individuals in a world which applauds conformity. And then in the last few panels, speaking of conformity, three individuals in identical blue outfits, come on, meet up with the thing in the butcher shop. We see that Machine Man left the Fantastic Four instructions on how to keep Ion cryogenically sealed until a cure for her condition can be discovered, which has not happened in the last 45 years, but fingers crossed. The end.
Who's going to be playing Ion in the MCU?
Oof, that's a tough one. That's a tough one.
I'm thinking you could handle the role of Gears Garvin, though. You got the same beard.
Wait a minute. That means you and I, that means you almost have the same beard as him.
No, my beard is much younger looking.
Oh, whoa.
We'll keep the same theory going. Yeah, you know what? Maybe, you know what? Now you just lost the role. You happy now?
Wait a minute. You're supposed to be my legal representative. You're my agent. What is happening here? I smell conflict of interest.
So, while I was overall disappointed with the artwork, just because I want so much more from Ditko, there were a couple of moments in this one where it does the not so much the Ditko superhero art, but I almost feel like the Ditko art from when he would do, you know, like those short horror stories.
Or Doctor Strange.
But like on the page when she gets bathed in the radiation, the bottom two, the last three panels on that page have the shading and shadowing the way I'm looking for it from him. The page where where Machine Man comes into the laboratory and he's trying to rescue the people and he removes his leg to use it as a lever, like the artwork there all seems good to me. That seems to be a Steve Ditko artwork that, you know, that I'm looking for. Then we get to the point where he's drawing the thing, and I just can't help but cringe.
Yeah, the one blessing in this story is that Sue Storm was not in it very much. As much as I love Sue, woof, that is not much of a likeness.
Yeah, he does okay with the Human Torch.
Yep. Yep. Thing is questionable also at various points. Although there's the even just in the scene from the cover, I think the Thing has a strange look on his face. But at least I can say, well, he's being squished by this huge piece of equipment. I can excuse that. Other parts, Thing looks pretty good. But it's on that very first page, we actually have the four headshots of the four. And I do not know.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like he's just drawing generic blonde.
Yeah, it is the Ditko round hair on round face. You know, round head with round hair.
Mm-hmm. Reed looks uncommonly happy.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
So, you know, the artwork is, it's got an ebb and flow to it as far as quality goes. You know, some of it I like, but most of it I'm finding, again, I would love to see somebody take the raw pencils from this and hand them over to Klaus Janson and see what he does with it.
What I do like of the art is I do like the character of Ion, that gaseous flow feel to that character. I think in some ways Ditko does better sort of with those things that are not standard human forms.
Which brings you to the Doctor Strange in Strange Tales.
Right. Yeah, that's sort of where I'm. What I was seeing in some of that, I said there's, you know, two phrases that should never go together. Yes, one, Steve Ditko, and House Style.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, that is not his thing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, it's funny because we're going to get into Jack Kirby in a few minutes, and sometimes I feel like you shouldn't have Jack Kirby in House Style because he was so much of an innovator, and yet he was the defining House Style for Marvel, you know, through the Silver Age and into the Bronze Age until John Romita became the House Style.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, but yeah, Steve Ditko should not be because he has a unique perspective on it. There's certain artists who, you know, should not be the defining factor for other artists because they are, you know, to imitate them is not to be creative on your own. You know, then it just becomes, you know, what are you doing to imitate this person? And that's handcuffing people too much. Now to take a style that's a little bit more clean, you know, the Kirby of the 60s or the John Romita of the 70s, it's not as bad because I don't think it's as much of a handcuff on the artist. And when I think about Jack Kirby not being a House Style, I'm really more or less thinking of the later Jack Kirby of the 70s.
Right.
Which we're going to get to in a moment. But, you know,
one thing I did like about this, and maybe it's because I read too many modern comics, and, you know, for us, modern means, you know, from the last 30 years, but it was nice to read a done in one, a one-off story, you know, but we talk some about the quality of the story, what we thought about that, but I need more issues like this in my life where I read it for 15 minutes, enjoy it while I have it and it's done.
I don't disagree with you. I felt that this story had a feel of a more Silver Age type, you know, flow to it. It didn't, you know, it was nothing monumental that was going to affect anybody's history, as shown by the fact that Ion has never reappeared.
yes.
But it, you know, it was enough of a threat. There was definitely the things with Machine Man and his civilian persona with Louis Anderson getting all upset with him on the picture there. I thought that was, you know, that was very 1960s Spider-Man-ish.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I kind of liked that. And then, you know, I like that the boss in the insurance company knows what he's, you know, his secret identity, and he actually sends him there to, you know, render aid to the people who are taking care of this problem. You know, it's not, you know, oh, how am I going to get there? Let me come up with some really lame excuse. You know, he goes and, you know, he's under orders, actually. So it's perfect as far as I'm concerned. And then, you know, the different things that the Machine Man's body does are amply and creatively on display. I don't know how I feel about him being given a wheel instead of two legs. But I'm guessing in issue 16, which it's been many, many years since I've read, that he goes back to having two legs at that point. So, you know, if that's the case, if it's a one and done as far as the wheel goes, I'm kind of cool with that. I do believe Gears Garvin becomes a repeating character. So, you know, that's cool too, because he, you know, he could have basically a mechanic being his man in the chair. So, that's all well done. And this is one where I'm finishing this up and I'm thinking, you know, I'd like to sit down and read issue 16. I don't know if I ever will, but I'd like to.
Looking back over my, I've been keeping records of the comics I've read for 10 years now. And in that time, I have read one other issue of Machine Man, number 3. But I don't know before that, you know, in the murky past. I'm not sure I've read, certainly have not read much Machine Man in my time, so coming to it fairly fresh.
Yeah, well, I do have this complete run, but I'm not 100% sure of how many issues of it I actually read.
Right.
You know, this is, when is this? This is 1980. So in June of 1980, so I was just graduating high school when this came out. So, you know, I was a big man then. I couldn't sit and, even though I was buying these comics, I couldn't sit and read them all.
That's right. Exactly.
I had alcohol to consume. and girls to turn me down. So I was busy.
Other thing broadly to say about comics of this era is that, you know, this is the, 5-6 year period, whatever it was, where we had 17 pages of content. And, you know, out of 32 pages, you need more than barely over half of your available page count going to the story. I guess in a way that's a counter to the inflation when we, at least now we're getting more pages, 20 to 22 for a regular comic. But this is what we've been experiencing, not just inflation, but we've come up with this word like 10 years ago to describe the situation where a price does not go up, but what you get is less and less. Actually called a shrinkflation. And so I guess that's what we're experiencing here by 1980.
It seems to be a regular thing where, you know, they'll shrink the number of issues, then they'll increase the price and increase the number of, pages, excuse me.
Right.
And then little by little, they'll decrease that again. And they'll just keep, you know, it's like a perpetual cycle. But you also can keep in mind that this is not that far removed from the era where you might have a 22-page story in a book, but 11 of them were one character and 11 of them were another character.
Sure.
So, you know, there is the ability to present the story in a smaller number of pages, although for the most part I have been seeing a lot of issues lately where I am lamenting the fact that there could be a few more pages. I often look at it and think, well, you could have developed this a little further. In this particular issue, I think if they had said, you know what, we're giving you 4 more pages, I think probably we would have ended up with 4 more battle pages. I don't think we would have gotten a lot of character.
That's the thing, Yeah, that's the thing.
I think the character moments that we were going to get in this story, we got.
We got, That's probably true. So
I'm kind of okay with the page count on this one. So, you know, overall, I enjoyed reading this. My disappointment with the artwork is probably more related to the fact that I hold Steve Ditko's earlier work in a certain amount of reverence.
Yeah.
And then to see, you know, that it's diminished bothers me a little bit. But other than that, that's by comparison, as opposed to, oh, I picked up this issue and I hated the art. I don't think that's the case.
Right. Yeah.
Well, although there's a couple of shots of the thing where I could say, yeah, I kind of rolled my eyes at.
And it is probably a cheat to say that the Fantastic Four are in this issue. Like the cover sort of promises and the inside first page promises. I'm not sure that's probably a marketing decision more than a creative.
To be fair, the cover just says the Thing and the Torch are whipped. It does not say anything about, you know, guest starring the Fantastic Four. True, it doesn't. It makes no representation of, you know, the Reed and Sue being in there. And even
except
in
what the first page does.
But even the first page I thought there was a comment about. No, I guess not.
It does say don't blink or miss Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah, okay, yeah, there was the comment. So I'm giving them a pass on that. I don't feel there's unfair marketing, and I believe me, I'm quick to complain when I think there's unfair fair marketing.
So I do wonder if there was we only have four more issues after this. It goes to 19. So I imagine the sales were in decline. So coming up with some sort of guest star, would not be uncommon in a situation like that to see if you can get a bump.
It looks like the remaining four issues are all Steve Ditko artwork within.
Yes, I think that's right.
And I'm kind of leaning towards I would like to read them. Now, whether or not I will, again, remains a mystery. But I am leaning towards it, so we'll see if that happens. You want to rate this one?
Yeah. And this, in terms of the cover, well, just in terms of the art in general, I'm sort of with you on Ditko, though I am probably more of a sucker for him. So even with my, you know, cold-hearted analytical mind, I just roll my eyes at a couple of the weirder moments and can move on. But you and I have also talked many times that I've never really developed that eye to tell, you know, particular artists from each other in that detail that you and so many others of our podcasting buddies can do.
You know, don't linger on the artwork that much. I think you can easily distinguish Steve Ditko from a house style artist.
That is what I was going to say, is that for me to note it, it has to be distinctive. So it has to be a Ditko or a Kirby or a Sienkiewicz or someone like that. It has to be someone really unique and different for me to tell. And so, you know, Ditko fits in that category, obviously, and so I do consider myself a fan. I like the colors, again, on the cover. I'm willing to give it a B. There's some action. You just need to come up with a better nickname than Machine Man, than MM. I mean, come on. This is lazy.
Or, you know, they could have just said Machine Man on the cover. There's enough room for them to have done that.
I was going to say, there is room there. There is room there.
They didn't have to, you know, it's not like, okay, you needed to squeeze it in.
Yeah. The interior art, actually, I think, because there's more of it and there's more weirdnesses, I would actually go a little bit lower, more on the B-minus side. I kind of like him, Machine Man, in battle mode. I like Ion. But the thing about Ditko is, I mean, you know going in that he does not draw, I'd say, realistic figures.
Yeah. He doesn't draw photorealistic images.
Right. But I do like Ditko human characters. They all do look different. As we, I mean, my joke is, you know, Ditko's human characters all look different. They're all ugly in their own unique way.
Well, that was one of the things that Chris Tyler has commented. We've done a few 70s Jack Kirby issues, and he's commented that nobody does ugly better than Jack Kirby.
Yep, there you go. There you go. Again, those humans can be a little cartoony. I think that's a little bit of the charm. Again, he certainly does not do character model. That is not what he does. So you have to go below average on, you know, when those when Ben and Johnny are on panel. But his strength is that he doesn't draw like anybody else, and his weakness is that he does not draw like anybody else. So I don't know. B minus on the interior side. Again, I think do need to take into account that, you know, those FF characters are often off model. Johnny's fine. Again, in terms of the story, again, you know, Tom DeFalco, solid professional scripter. Again, there's something fun, something throwback about a beginning, middle, and an end. I like the side characters. It really did have a bronze. I mean, it's 1980, but this had a earlier feel in terms of the way the story was told. It's 17 pages, but used them pretty well. Complete story. I would actually go a B plus overall, B ish. Not sure what to expect, having read only one issue of the title before, but. It goes solid, and certainly my blind devotion to Ditko's work might be making me a much easier grader. I am not blindly devoted to my students' work, so totally different vibe.
That's fair. So we're not really that far off. I'm not enamored with the cover. In fact, I think less of the cover than I do the interior art. I'm going to say the cover is passable, and I'm just going to give it a C. I don't think it's something where you'd see it and say, oh, I need this book. But it's, you know, it's passable. I think it would be much, much more compelling if instead of a light yellow background, if it had a darker background. I think even if the images were the way they are portrayed here, I think they would be, it would just pop out a little bit more at you.
Yeah, I think you're correct in pointing out that some of the best individual panels of the issue were those ones with the dark background.
The interior art, I think, has moments that it shines, where the, you know, the older Steve Ditko comes to fore. So I'm going to say the interior art, I'm going to give it a B minus. Which I think, honestly, I think I'm being a little generous on it because I was thinking of going C plus, but
yeah.
But I think it's, like I said, it's got its moments, but, you know, as you say, we can't discount the ones that are not good. You know, where you have to rate the whole thing. So it has its moments where it's really good, and it has its moments where it's really solid, and it has its moments where it's really shaky. So I'm going to say a B minus. The story, I found the story to be overall entertaining, but probably forgettable. If I don't read the follow-up issues on this, I'm probably not going to remember what happened in this one a month from now. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the time I spent reading it. Again, like you say, beginning, middle, and end. It has a 60s Marvel feel to it, which I don't have a problem with at all. I'm going to say a solid B on the story. And overall, I'll give the book a B minus.
Reasonable.
So that brings us to my book. And as the professor said, when he picks his book, usually I try to pick something that feels like it's going to go with it. I went with first issue special number 5, which features Manhunter, and it's a Jack Kirby book. It is, let me just get to my indication here. It's written and penciled and edited by Kirby. It is inked and lettered by B. Bruce Berry, who I'm not familiar with. And the cover is the same pair.
Yeah, I think he was one of Kirby's regular collaborators in the 80s, 70s and 80s on some of this DC work. I've run across the name a few times. It's not one of his main guys, Mike Royer or someone mm-hmm. like that. Maybe the next level down in terms of the number of times they collaborated.
No, but it you know, it does have a similar look to, say, a Mike Royer inked project. Yep. And I think that is because even at this point in his career, Kirby was still doing very detailed pencil work. If you see Kirby's penciled pages, which, you know, a lot of them are available on the internet to look at, it really looks like he would be just incredibly easy to ink because he really puts it all out there for you, and all you need to do is take your India ink and just be careful to stay in the lines. I think you see a similar look no matter what. This book came to me because I am vaguely familiar with the Manhunters, but I don't know really too much about them. I know I've read the JLA issues that followed up from this one, but I have no memory of what they were. And in my mind, I created an image where the Manhunters were robotic, not people, which is why I chose this one to try and checkmate your Machine Man. But I failed and was taken out by a pawn.
I think in your later... In the later retconning of this, I think your instinct is right. I think they were more android beings related to the Guardians.
I believe so. I suspect what happened is that they eventually replaced the human Manhunters with robotic or android Manhunters, and this way the continuity is still intact. You know, as opposed to just retconning it. So, but I was not familiar with this. I don't think I ever read this story before. It opens up with a Manhunter entering the cave of the Talking Heads, and there's a head, looks almost simian-like, that's hanging from a nail or a screw or a push pin or something. And it's saying, "We knew you'd come, Manhunter, sooner or later." Then we have the double page spread that is a Kirby staple. And there's all sorts of heads on posts and hanging and just there. And, you know, aliens and different things. And they're all basically calling for the Manhunter's death. They start shooting different things at him. He ends up confronting the leader of this group, who actually has a body and just an alien look about him, and his name is Chopper. And in chapter 2, he takes a shot at the Manhunter, but the Manhunter shoots him, and then we see that the alien head is a mask, and he tries to take an axe and take out the Manhunter, which ends up with some sort of electric feedback on him, and he gets knocked out. The Manhunter removes his mask and reveals a face somewhere in age between Professor Allen's age and mine, with graying eyebrows, and says, you know, the Grim Reaper is pursuing him, and he's grown old, old. He says, my next case could be my last, but the work must go on. If justice fails, civilization fails. So from there, we cut to a quiet suburb of a small college town where Mark Shaw, a criminal defense attorney, is speaking to his uncle, who has got the fashion choice that I am jealous of. He wears the glasses, not the monocle, the glasses, but they have no eye posts on, or no ear posts on them. They're just balanced on his nose, and they stay there. Otherwise looking, you know, kind of Lex Luthor-like with the cigarette holder. Mark is bemoaning his inability to defend somebody who he's trying to, and to get justice for the gentleman. The uncle lets him know about the Manhunters, and he reaches out to them somehow and is sent a Manhunter costume. And, well, he's not quite sent it yet, because first we rejoin the original Manhunter, who's there with the Grandmaster, who the original Manhunter is telling him that he's old, he fears his days are numbered. And the Grandmaster, who has kind of an Odin look about him, says, you know, fate wills it, will a new warrior will arise. So at that point, some sort of talking lion head cube thing, which, you know, is giant, like three times the size of the height of the men, says, or speaks through him, Mark Shaw, who's letting them know that he's looking for something to go. Days later, at the home of Mark Shaw's uncle, the uncle walks in, and Mark is in the costume. And the uncle tells him, Mark, it worked. When you talked into the mystic medallion, I almost said metal lion, the Shan responded, and the costume and mask arrived today.
In your defense, it was a metal lion.
Yes, and the way it's, just to be even a little bit more in my defense, the way it's written on the page, it's M-E-D-A-L apostrophe, and then on the next page, L-I-O-N.
Yeah.
So they've chosen him to be a candidate for a Manhunter. And apparently this suit has some sort of powers to it, because the uncle reveals to him that his client, who he's been trying to get justice for, was murdered. And the gangsters, who are drawn in typical Kirby fashion, come into the uncle's house and they're ready to take them out. So now at this point, you know, to my knowledge, Mark Shaw is just a regular defense attorney, maybe in good shape, but a regular defense attorney. But he's got the Manhunter costume on, and he demonstrates some physical abilities that are, you know, beyond the mortal man. So I assume the costume itself gives him some sort of powers. They provide him the name, you know, well, he dangles one out the window, and they provide them the name of their boss, who is Al Beefer, the Hog. So at that point, he says
Wouldn't Beefer be the cow?
You would think.
I'm not judging the underworld nickname.
On the other hand, Al Porker might have a different connotation to it. Well, bovine is cow, ovine is pig, right?
Porcine?
What would ovine be then?
Isn't that egg related?
I'm not certain. But maybe, you know, it would have been more clever to have a name of that, you know, porcine or ovine or whatever it goes.
Ovine sheep. Ovine is sheep.
Oh, sheep. Okay, so you're probably right. Porcine is the pig. So it would have been better if that was his name, but maybe Kirby felt that was too on point. So anyway, the man...
Right, because subtlety really is Kirby's comic
book. So Mark decides to go after him, and he takes the quickest exit, meaning he jumps out the window. And this is all being watched in the headquarters of the Shan. Our candidate is off to his first test, Grandmaster. He is swift, he moves well. He was down from that tree in seconds. My hopes are raised, sire. When he earns his baton, I shall be free of my duty. So, that said, we see a shot of the person who I assume is the Porker. And it says, the next image that appears reflects the ruthless face of evil, grown powerful and cunning in its continued forays against society. It's the face of Manhunter's target. Want to see the clash between Manhunter and the Hog? If so, write us and tell us. So this is a to-be-continued story that they don't know if they're ever going to continue. I know the next appearance of the Manhunters is in JLA, I believe, 141 and 142. So I may have to reread those to know where it's going. So this is not a done in one. It's to be continued, maybe, which is a little troublesome. But anyway,
I think that more or less was the idea of first issue special. You know, it was the old showcase tryout sort of, you know, concept.
But when we covered the Warlord issue, which I believe was the one before this, number four, that issue ended with an indication that Warlord number one is coming out next month.
Right.
So gotcha. This is a concept that I think DC didn't have quite the same confidence in. And Kirby probably had it all committed to paper, you know, drawn and ready to go before they even made a decision on what they wanted to do with it. So, you know, that's why they threw in the, if you want to see more, write us and tell us. You know, they weren't going to throw it away at that point, I don't believe. And I have always enjoyed series like this, where if they have quality stories that are, you know, just inventory, they could present them. But, you know, often they present some that are not necessarily of the same quality. This was fun to me, not the same way as Machine Man. It was definitely a different type of fun. But I felt that this is one where, and now this is a 21-page story, I think this would have benefited from about four more pages on it, where you could have said how he, you know, did he train? Did the costume give him his powers? Maybe, you know, even put another page of the fight between him and the thugs. A little bit more of him investigating where he was going to go after this hog. You know, a little. I think it could have used a little bit more fleshing out than it gave us. But I still enjoyed reading it.
I like the international aspect, sort of this mysterious secret society. I mean, I think that's a nice hook, you know, to grab your interest. In addition to the specific, you know, deal with the hog that he's dealing with, you know, short term, you have this bigger overarching group or society or institution. I think that's got a nice sense of appeal to it.
Which could also be fodder for a lot more eventually going on, right, in the stories.
Exactly. That could be part of your story engine. So you sort of can see the logic that's being built into this debut story. But so, to clarify, we've got an old man and we've got a heroic lawyer. Yeah. Not sure why you picked this one. That's a mystery to me.
Felt it was indicative of me and you.
Hey, whoa.
This one, did you ever read the OMAC series by Kirby?
Yes,
The opening of this with the cave with all these faces and all that gave me a distinct feel of the opening of OMAC, where he goes into like the Build-A-Friend factory.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Like,
the cover, that first page, and then that two-page spread, it's almost like you get the feeling that Kirby had this idea. Okay. It's a cave. It's got heads. The heads talk. I have no idea what I'm going to do with that, but I'm going to use that somewhere. Yeah, no idea if that's actually the thought process, but like, I've got this awesome visual, this awesome idea. I'm going to put it somewhere.
But I think that was
I think something like that may have come to be.
I think that was typical of Kirby. I think he had these grandiose ideas and he wasn't sure exactly how to ground them. And sometimes to flesh them out. But I think, you know, I think you see, like, when he was teamed with Stan Lee, Stan would know how to ground them a little bit and would bring them along, you know, but in the Fantastic Four, the introduction of the Inhumans and the introduction of the Kree and just so many different things that went on, and they just seem more accessible. Whereas when Kirby went on his own, he still had these grandiose ideas, you know, the new gods, the Eternals, you know, even Commandy, and just all these different things that he had in his head. But he lacked the partner who would help him to just kind of dialogue it and ground it a little bit. But I mean, the ideas are phenomenal, and you see how over the years, when you look at, like, just, you know, we talk about the MCU, how much of that, you know, of the really quality stuff in the MCU, how much of that either came from Kirby or Jim Starlin? It's just, right. You know, yeah. So much of it, it's crazy. So, you know, I give him credit. And sometimes as an older reader, I'm more capable of reading a story like this and not relating to it, but just enjoying it than I was as a younger reader, where I'd be like, well, where's this going? I don't quite get it, you know?
Yeah. I do have a little bit of a grudge or hard feelings about this specific issue, this character, because this was, what, 75?
Yes.
And I think it was 73 and 74 that gave us the Paul Kirk Manhunter from I'm drawing a blank on the creators. Goodwin, Archie Goodwin, and Simonson. I mean, just a cool Detective Comics. Just such a cool character, a cool look, really great stories. And I'm bummed by the fact that this character, and then leading into the Manhunters and all of that, kind of push that Paul Kirk character aside. Those were terrific stories.
Now, I don't think I've ever read a Paul Kirk Manhunter story, but while you were talking about it, I just punched up the Wikipedia page on it, and it says, created by Jack Kirby and Joe Simon.
Huh.
So that could have easily been a long-form tie-in to this.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. Okay.
You know, almost like the Starman thing where they tie in stuff.
Right, right. That's true, too. True, too. I mean, you know, there are some names that are so, like, almost generic, like Starman and Manhunter.
Okay. You know, consider...
You almost see them.
Consider that his first appearance, where he's created by Kirby and Simon, January 1941, Adventure Comics number 58.
So maybe Kirby is saying to I'm going to come back to DC, but I'm going to take my character name back.
So, you know, yeah, it's. I'm just looking, you know, giving
wild.
It a quick
wild.
Quick oh, glance. It said in 1973, cool. Decades after his original run of stories ended, Archie Goodwin and Walt Simonson brought back Paul right. Kirk in his Manhunter role in Detective Comics 437. So, you know, there is something, but that's not
this storyline.
But you could have somehow connected them.
I mean, you tie him in, sure. Yep.
I definitely think if this had... true. You know, if this had... I think there was actually a Manhunter series at some point. But not one that I've ever actually...
You're right.
You know, that I have any familiarity with.
But I do approve of the figuring out how to make this guy part of this bigger deal and tying it into Green Lantern and the Guardians. I think that bit of retconning, or, you know, again, retconning sometimes has such a negative connotation. I mean, taking something from your past, updating it, and using it currently.
Yeah,
I think that's actually one of the more successful.
There is a distinction between retconning something and tying something together. You know, retconning is you're taking what you've already established and saying, forget that, this is the way it happened. Whereas I think that is usually the more lazy way of doing it. Whereas, you know, you get certain writers, I think, you know, Roy Thomas was the first one who started doing yep. that. And then eventually, you know, Kurt Busiek and guys like that would do a lot of that, where they'd take the old stuff and rather than retcon it, they would... just kind of figure a way to piece it all together. Now, sometimes that ended up with a very, very complex piece of continuity. But I do appreciate the effort that would go into that and how they would do it. You know, this story just to kind of go back to that a little bit, it just reeks of 70s Kirby wildness, you know, and I could see where if this had been an ongoing, you know, it would have been probably very similar to the OMAC series in its own way, or the, you know, the issues of Jimmy Olsen that he had done. But I could also see where other writers could take this and just kind of flesh it out to the point where it would be, you know, something that you'd want to see them make a movie of. So I definitely see the potential here. And I enjoyed reading this issue. It was, you know, a nice, comfortable read.
Yeah, I think the visuals are very striking, especially that the cover and the cave, the talking decapitated head. I mean, come on. That's just awesome.
I find it interesting that the cover and then the initial splash page are almost mirror images of each other.
Yes, I think, yeah.
Different enough that it doesn't look like he just, you know, reprinted his own stuff. It looks like the Manhunter is the same.
I think that, yes.
Or actually, it could be the same and just the coloring is different on the face.
Yeah.
But either way, I found it striking. This is an issue where at, what is it, 1975, so at, you know, 12 years old, I probably would want to pick this up. I don't think I did, but that doesn't mean I wouldn't have wanted to. I think the cover is striking, and I'm kind of cool on it. And I'm going to jump right into the fact that I'm going to give the cover a B+. I don't think it's iconic. I don't think it's something I necessarily want to hang up on my wall, but I think it's very compelling.
Would you rather hang the cover on the wall or hang the head on the wall?
Oh, the head. No question, the head. Get me that push pin and he's hanging.
That's an A+. The head's an A+.
So the interior art is, it's Kirby of the era. It is unique, and this is the Kirby that should not be a house style, as we were talking about earlier. But it's, you know, I follow along with it. I think it's dynamic at points. I don't think it has that, you know, as Kirby got older, I think he everything became too squared off. But I don't think this quite has that yet. I think this is still quality. So I'm going to say a solid B on the interior art. And the story is kind of fun. So a B on the story as well. Overall, I'll give the book a B.
Yeah, I think I think that color is great. I mean, the cover is great. I don't think when this came out, I was overseas, I think 75, 76, 77. I may not have seen it till I came back, but which would have been put me at maybe 12 or 13, so it's the same age you, which, you know, is the golden age of comics. And I do remember seeing this cover. To me, it is iconic just because it's been in my mind for 40-some years. Again, it's a talking head nailed to a wall. What is not to love? So I'm willing to give that A-, B+, A-. I think the art inside is really good. Again, relating Ditko to Kirby, you know, I have no problem identifying Kirby's artwork.
Yeah.
Obviously. It's 100% identifiable. I love it. Again, those first couple pages, that two-page spread is great. A lot of great stuff in there. You've got weird-looking beings, strange energies, everything you want on the artistic side. Again, probably A-. I think the story's a B. I think it's really good. It really fits into that, again, sort of that 70s model of the sort of the globe-spanning epic, the mysteries of this organization. So I think I would call it an issue of its time, but also one that sort of transcends its time. In fact, I think it still holds together 50 years later. Hard to say. I'd give the story a B, and to me we're looking at a B+, A-. Overall here. So I enjoyed that. You know, of the creations that came out of first issue special, obviously Warlord is the one that, you know, stands astride them all like a colossus in terms of its duration. You know, some of the concepts remain beloved to a elite small cadre of geeks. I'm looking at you, Lady Cop, the Creeper, or the Dingbats of Danger Street, right?
Yep.
You know, and a couple of them were reboots, Metamorpho and Dr. Fate.
Return of the New Gods. Aside.
Yeah, if you sort of set those ones aside, this one's probably one of the stronger of those concepts. Again, that's remained a part of the DC lore in terms of that being revisited and revised, if we like that more than retconned.
Agreed.
So I think it's one of the better first issue special stories. I think it's better than Atlas. That was one of the, what was the other one Kirby did?
He did the Dingbats also.
The Dingbats, yeah. Yeah, I think he did three or four. I think this is probably
take a quick look.
The strongest one of his.
I'm just trying to look quickly. First issue was Atlas. Second issue was the Green Team. Who's that one by? That is definitely not Kirby. Joe Simon and Jerry Grandinetti. Third issue is Metamorpho. That's also not Kirby. Fourth issue was Lady Cop. Now, just the side story on Lady Cop was when I was trying to complete this series, that was the issue I had trouble finding.
Yeah.
And I've kind of gone over that, how I refused to pay more than you know, a buck or two for that issue until I finally found it. But one of the guys in the comic store that I was talking about, it says, you know, the problem with an issue like that is when they buy a collection, they don't look at that as one that people are searching for. So sometimes instead of going into the dollar bin, it goes into the warehouse because they just don't have room for it. And we have Manhunter is next. The Dingbats were after that, which is also a Kirby weird book. Then we have the Creeper, Warlord, Dr. Fate, the Outsiders, Codename Assassin, Starman, and Return of the New Gods. That's the entire run of first issue special. Then I think there was like an unpublished issue also, but I can't recall off the top of my head.
Right.
So
I've not read the was it called Danger Street from a couple years ago? A DC title, I think maybe by Tom King, that sort of told an ongoing sort of current day story, but it brought in
the Dingbats
concept and characters. I think each one of them.
Because this is the Dingbats of Danger Street.
Yes. Yep. But I believe it brought in all of the, or at least all of the obscure DC, you know, characters from first issue special. So Lady Cop makes an appearance, et cetera.
That'd be cool. I would want to check that out. I know the character of Atlas was brought back in, I believe, Action Comics, where he faced off against Superman. But yeah, overall, this was, you know, this I like these tryout series.
Yeah.
Although some, you know, I have a lot of them. But it did seem like sometimes they would fall into the, we're trying out this character. Well, now we're going to give this character a run of 8 or 9 issues. You know, it's especially in Marvel, you know, like Marvel Premiere, you know, when they introduced Iron Fist, right. All of a sudden, you know, you had 7 or 8 issues before he got his own series. Marvel Spotlight, you had the same thing with Son of Satan. You know, I like a series where it's like, you know, give me a one and done, test out the character and see whether or not they merit their own series. But, you know, those series were primarily that, even though they occasionally went into a run of a specific character.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess that's going to do it for this particular episode. But as we mentioned earlier, we do have plans to be speaking again.
Yeah.
I will be planning to be on Professor Allen show, and I will plan to bring Professor Allen kicking and screaming and drag him back on this show.
It's a deal. It's a deal. I mean, look, you can just send this. You can just send an invitation. I don't need a subpoena, but look, whatever works for you.
It's going to be a subpoena combined with a protective order. So it's an interesting concept. So if we haven't mentioned it yet, Professor Allen has the Quarter Bin podcast on the Relatively Geeky Network. And I would again tell you, you know, seek it out.
Check it out.
And thank you for listening. Thank you for coming on with me, Professor Allen. And we'll see you all next week with something. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.